You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll find out how an Appleton museum is using special kits to introduce kids to diverse cultures, even when they can't tour the museum in person. Now, the second impeachment trial against former President Trump is in the books. On Saturday, 57 senators voted to convict the president of inciting the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. 43 voted to acquit him. 67 votes were needed to convict. 7 Republicans voted with all 50 Democrats. In a statement after the vote, Trump called the impeachment effort a witch hunt. He also thanked his supporters, saying, quote, "Soon we will emerge with a vision for a bright, radiant, and limitless American future." While the political trial failed to convict Trump, he could still face criminal and civil charges. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your takeaways from the impeachment effort? How much blame, if any, do you think the former president deserves for what happened at the Capitol on January 6th? Do you support or oppose calls for a panel to look into the causes of the insurrection on January 6th? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Andra Gillespie is an associate professor of political science at Emory University in Atlanta. Andra, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we had some last-minute drama on Saturday morning with the question of whether to take witnesses. They were gonna, then they decided not to. What did you make of the events of Saturday leading up to the vote, ultimately not convicting the president in this impeachment?
Well, I can't say that I was surprised by the eventual outcome. I think we have to ask ourselves, what does it mean that this was the most bipartisan impeachment in U.S. history, where you have 10 members of the president's party vote to impeach in the House and you have 7 members of the Senate vote to convict? I think that there are some really serious long-term questions that we have to ask about whether or not impeachment is a viable option. The framers didn't mean for it to be used lightly. We shouldn't just kick out presidents on a whim. But when serious allegations such as these, which were aired on national television in real time, lead to a conviction because people are arguing about technicalities, I think we have to ask ourselves whether or not people are going to be willing to use impeachment against a president, or whether or not this, you know, is a partisan exercise. Because to the extent that it's partisan, this is the framers' worst nightmare, and these are all the warnings about factionalism that are actually coming to life. That being said, President Trump is still probably going to be subjected to something civil or criminal, whether it's related to the insurrection or whether it's related to some of his business dealings, or how he tried to talk with election officials in states about the 2020 election results. There still is the possibility that Congress may try to invoke the 14th Amendment to try to prevent President Trump from running for office. But with all of that said and done, Trumpism, is here, and it's still viable even after this impeachment trial.
Another open question, and members of Congress, including Speaker Pelosi, are weighing in on this as recently as today. What kind of investigation might happen for January 6th? The Speaker is saying a 9/11 commission style commission. Looking at that, this is still, I think, in the planning stages. What kind of things are you looking for, Andra, as Congress considers how they look at this attack on their stomping grounds in the nation's capital?
Well, yeah, I mean, because this happened in their office space, there are legitimate security questions. The Capitol Police need to be investigated. There needs to be a federal investigation of how the overlapping jurisdictions work with each other and how they worked against each other on January 6th. So, if only because this happened on their turf and because their very security was at stake on January 6th, it makes sense for the legislative branch to engage in some oversight activity to look into what happened to try to prevent something like this from happening again.
Talking to Andra Gillespie from Emory University, looking at the second impeachment trial for President Trump, now complete as of Saturday. You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Want to check out some different responses from members of the U.S. Senate. Let's start with Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer on the Senate floor after senators voted to acquit the former president.
Despite the results of the vote on Donald Trump's conviction in the court of impeachment, he deserves to be convicted, and I believe he will be convicted in the court of public opinion. He deserves to be permanently discredited, and I believe he has been discredited in the eyes of the American people and in the judgment of history. Even though Republican senators prevented the Senate from disqualifying Donald Trump for any office of honor, trust, or profit under these United States, there is no question Donald Trump has disqualified himself. I hope, I pray, and I believe that the American people will make sure of that.
I won't ask you to predict the future, Andra, but what do you look at when you wonder whether President Trump himself has a future role to play in American politics?
Well, he's going to try to play a role. We don't know what that role is. We don't know if Congress will circumscribe his ability to be able to run for federal office again via the 14th Amendment. But suffice to say, based on, what we've seen this weekend, it looks like many Republicans, one, are still very loyal to him. And two, there are many people who would seek his endorsement and would seek to curry favor with him. And so even if Donald Trump exits the scene, Trumpism is still alive and well in the United States. According to, the NBC, Wall Street Journal poll, probably the Republican Party is split probably 50-50 versus establishment Republicans and those who are loyal to Trump. So, the Republican Party, still has a populist wing that right now is represented by Donald Trump. And if he goes away, there is very likely going to be somebody else who emerges. They may not have the same type of charisma or the same platform that had been cultivated through years of having, been a public figure. I think it would remains to be seen sort of how cohesive that populist wing would be under another leader. But it's, I don't see any evidence that it's going away just yet.
Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson voted to acquit the president. He was on WISN Radio in Milwaukee this morning and explained some of his thinking in his vote.
So as a juror sitting in that trial, what's going through my mind while the House managers are making their case is, okay, you're accusing Donald Trump of all this stuff. What about Hillary Clinton telling Biden? I'm actually surprised the lawyers never pointed this out. She advised him never to concede the race. Mm-hmm. How about all of you folks that never condemned the BLM and Antifa peaceful protests that turned to riots that burned down dozens of buildings in Racine? And we are aware of their hypocrisy. We know who is talking to us about and saying how important police officials are when their side has been saying defund the police. So you're sitting in that trial, you're listening to all this, and you understand it's just dripping with hypocrisy.
Senator Johnson there, Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin, he also said he didn't see the events at the Capitol as an armed insurrection. What do you make of Senator Johnson, Andra, and those comments?
With all due respect to Senator Johnson, I mean, thing one, he's behaving in a really hyper-partisan manner. And then I think second, he's creating false equivalences. In the closing arguments on Saturday, Michael Van Der Veen, who kind of ended up assuming the lead defense role for President Trump, made the claim that the people who, mounted the insurrection on the Capitol learned that they could get away with such things because of the Black Lives Matter protests. And that argument is just completely disingenuous, and I would argue racist. It's just not the same. So yes, I'm not discounting that, some BLM protests turned violent. Wasn't because of the organizers of Black Lives Matter. They were very clear about the fact that they were trying to do peaceful protests and that there were outside agitators who were coming in and trying to capitalize on the moment, to make headlines or to make their own point. The other thing that I would point out for people like, Hillary Clinton, who, of course, had a hard time accepting the election results from a personal standpoint, or even Stacey Abrams in my own state, while they thought that their elections had been robbed from them, They accepted the election results. They didn't, bring dozens of frivolous lawsuits that got thrown out of court. Not that they didn't bring lawsuits, dozens of lawsuits. They didn't try to bring in legislators to try to overturn the results of the election. And they didn't continually say that they won, even when it was clear that they weren't going to win the election. And most important, their supporters didn't try to storm a capital, whether it's the U.S. Capitol or a state capitol, to, attempt to try to hang the vice president if he didn't assume the authority to try to not certify the election results. So I just don't think the comparisons are like even close to being sort of equivalent to one another. And so I just think that it's sloppy and hyper-partisan to make those kinds of claims.
We're talking about the second Senate impeachment trial of former President Trump, his acquittal, and what happens next. Andra Gillespie is with us, associate professor of political science at Emory University in Atlanta. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your takeaway from this latest impeachment effort? Do you see the former president having any responsibility for the riot at the Capitol? Do you want to see a commission, kind of like the 9/11 commission, go back and investigate what happened? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about former President Trump's impeachment trial that concluded on Saturday. The Senate would need 67 votes to have convicted Trump on the charge of the incite of the riot at the Capitol. They only got 57. Seven Republicans sided with all 50 Democrats. You could join in with your thoughts and reactions at 800-642-1234. I want to give a listen now to Senate Minority Leader Republican Mitch McConnell. He voted to acquit the president on the argument that the trial was unconstitutional, but he then blamed Trump for what happened on January 6th. Here's some of what he had to say after the vote.
There's no question. None. That President Trump is practically and morally responsible for provoking the events of the day. No question about it. The people who stormed this building believed they were acting on the wishes and instructions of their president.
Andra, with a statement like that and what we heard from Senator Johnson earlier and others, there's going to be some interesting conversations among the Senate Republican caucus and other Republicans around the country.
Yes. I mean, it was really interesting to hear Minority Leader McConnell kind of make his speech, because as he was making his speech, it sounded like he was giving every reason to convict President Trump. And so by choosing to fall back on the "we can't convict somebody who's no longer in office," in some ways he was reifying the January exception, which I think is a really dangerous precedent in the United States. Even though we're not talking about precedent in the same way that we would talk about it in the context of the Supreme Court, people learn things from impeachment. So, I doubt after the Bill Clinton impeachment, anybody else would ever be brought up on charges for lying about an extramarital affair. And so what does it mean when you say that you can't impeach a president, for an impeachment process that started before he left office because he isn't in office anymore? And in particular, if you can't be impeached for inciting an insurrection, even if some of the people who voted to acquit believe that, what does it mean when you can't remove a president from office for doing something that was so visceral and that, ended up playing out, in front of all of us as we watched from our homes? I think that there's some serious long-term ramifications for what McConnell said. On the other hand, I do take seriously some of the reporting that's been done by journalists that suggests that McConnell did this because he kind of knew the direction in which his caucus was going to go, and it would make it difficult for him to lead if he actually went with the minority on this particular instance. And I do also think that it was somewhat telling that it seemed to suggest that McConnell was actually really open to a criminal investigation of President Trump. If there were DAs and U.S. attorneys, who may have felt that perhaps they needed to defer to Republicans on this, perhaps McConnell was giving them cover, even though prosecutors are supposed to be acting in a neutral fashion. So, there's some really interesting kind of intrigue that people are speculating about. We'll have to see how this plays out. But I mean, I have to admit, it was really weird to hear Leader McConnell basically say, yeah, I believe everything that was laid out in the articles of impeachment. But yeah, I think time ran out. If he were fouled in a basketball game in the last second of a game, he would still get his free throws. And so I just find that argument to not really hold water. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Amber is with us in La Crosse. Amber, hi.
Hi, thank you. Yeah, I just wanted to say that this whole process this year has been exhausting, mentally draining, and the reason that I am have a very poor relationship now with most of my family. For Mitch McConnell to wait this long and finally decide to have a spine was especially exhausting for me. I'll look forward to the day when Trump isn't the first thing that pops in my head when I go to work.
Amber, thanks a lot for the call. And Andra, between the president and other things going, the former president, other things going on, Amber pointing toward a lot of division in the United States, even in her case, amongst her family members. How do you see us coming back from that state where we feel so divided?
Unfortunately, I think we're still divided. I think we are hyper-partisan. I think people are making decisions based on, the letter behind people's names. And this is really unfortunate. And I don't think that in this case, I'm going to use the viral analogy. I don't think that fever has broken yet. What it's going to take are people on both sides of the aisle who are willing to be courageous and stand up to their party when they think that the direction of the party is headed in the wrong direction, and people who are going to be willing to work with people on the other side of the aisle, even if it yields them a primary challenge and even if they might lose an election. If enough people do it, they won't all lose. And I think in our personal lives, we are going to have to learn to listen. And learn how to still keep lines of communication open. And this is something that I say to myself. I come from a politically mixed family where there have been some heated discussions. I will say, fortunately, everybody is still talking to each other. And I think that that's important. I think it's also going to be incumbent upon us to remove people from office via the vote who are obstructionists and who don't want to cooperate. And I think finally, one of the things that we've seen in the last year and in the last few years is that there's a severe deficit in civics education, which is leading people to be susceptible to misinformation. And it's going to take some time to be able to combat that. So, what I hope is that we will redouble our efforts and prioritize civics education and update it for the 21st century so that people know how to be able to identify misinformation, how not to fall for deep fakes and other kinds of things that might lead people down really dangerous paths that could endanger themselves and others.
Let's bring on another caller now. Willem is with us in Colfax. Willem, hi.
Hi. I'm an immigrant to this country. My father was in a concentration camp. He was a resistor. He resisted the Nazis in the Dutch resistance. His brother was executed. We came to this country, I think, partly because of my parents feared that what happened in Hungary, that it might happen again. And he thought that America would be a place, because they're always talked about the exceptionalism of America, where something like what happened to the Weimar Republic could never happen in the United States. So, and I was raised to not believe liars and bullies, but I think that President Trump clearly caused this, because he set the date of January 6th, at the certification of the election, an election that he spent $50 million in advertising about the stolen election. Even on that day, he said, everyone knows we won in a landslide. And this lie is what created all the turmoil. And no president in U.S. history has ever done this, lied about the election. After all the judges threw out the cases and the Electoral College had said that Joe Biden won and his own administration said it was a fair and open election, Donald Trump persisted in this lie.
Willem, thanks a lot for the call. Andra Willem, as House impeachment managers did, made the case that the January 6th insurrection and the president's speech was just the culmination of a couple months of rejecting election results.
I mean, I agree with that. That comports with what I remember and what I saw on January 6th and the things that I saw on social media leading up to January 6th. So I think it takes, a lot of mental gymnastics to try to not tie the insurrection to the language and to the lie about the election results. Everybody was there, one, to put pressure on Mike Pence, because every other method of trying to overturn the election results had failed, and this was the last ditch effort. So it was all going to be over at this point, and people went for broke. And we're going to have to acknowledge that. So until we acknowledge that, and until people who may have supported President Trump's agenda, maybe you'd like the economic gains that were made before the pandemic, actually acknowledge that that came along with a whole bunch of other bad stuff and some stuff that was destabilizing, it's going to be really hard for us to move forward. And so what people are calling for is an acknowledgement and a recognition of the things that went wrong and a pledge to do better. But instead, because of hyper-partisanship, what we're seeing is people doubling down on not just the good things, but they're doubling down on the bad things too, in a way that is intellectually indefensible and at the end of the day actually does more harm to our democracy than it does good.
And just briefly, as we wrap up, Andra, now that we're past impeachment, do you see opportunities for Republicans and Democrats to work together in at least some positive ways?
I hope that it happens. I think that, when people try to say that, oh, let's just move past this and pretend that it didn't happen, I don't think that that's helpful. I think sometimes it's important to sort of, understand, when a group doesn't have quite the moral authority to be able to make certain demands and claims, or when just by virtue of the numbers that they have, when they realize, that sometimes the leverage that they have is limited. I think, that would be true, if Democrats were in this situation as well. So, I think that there will be some places. I think what's most important for President Biden is to make sure that he's in communication with Republicans. So even when Republicans aren't getting what they want legislatively, if he's being transparent with them and is including them in the discussions, even if they lose votes because they just don't have the numbers, I think that that's a step forward. But, Republicans are going to have to be used to being in the minority party for, a while until the next election. Then we have to see whether or not they are able to make gains.
Andra, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
Andra Gillespie is an associate professor of political science at Emory University in Atlanta. We talked to her about former President Trump's acquittal in his second impeachment trial and the politics that followed it. Coming up, we'll hear about an Appleton museum offering families take-home activity kits focused on diversity. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll find out how our lakes are getting ready to wake up for warmer temperatures. Now, one highly interactive place, a children's museum, has adapted their offerings to suit in-person and at-home learners. At the Building for Kids in Appleton, the month of February is dedicated to diversity discovery at the museum. To make it accessible to everyone, they're offering kits for families to take home. Beth Vanderloop is Director of Programs and Community Engagement at the Building for Kids in Appleton. Beth, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me today.
Before we get into this take-home program, what's it been like to be a children's museum, which I think of as the ultimate interactive hands-on museum during this pandemic year?
It has certainly been a learning experience, I would say. Obviously, it's presented a lot of new challenges for our organization, but one thing that we have felt really proud about throughout, now almost the past year, is that we never stopped serving families in our community. We have found innovative ways to still reach out, either through activity kits or now we are open by registration, so we can actually welcome families through our doors. Not to the same level that we used to, but at least there's still that connection. So it's just been a matter of finding new ways to do the things we know how to do.
And tell us about the Diversity Discovery Month at the Building for Kids and these kits.
Sure. So traditionally, the Building for Kids would have hosted a Diversity Discovery Day at the museum. So this would have been a free day for people from our community to come in and experience all the diverse groups that our community has. And so we would usually welcome a number of our partner agencies to come and do projects and performances with all the people coming to see us. Obviously, this year, that is not really a possibility. It was an event that usually drew in over 2,000 people. So we're not hosting anything like that these days. So we decided to turn the month of February into Diversity Discovery Month. And we're featuring kits that have projects from some of our partner agencies, such as the University of Green Bay's Multi-Ethnic Student Affairs Group, Appleton Public Library's Hispanic Family Outreach Specialist, and then Wisconsin's as well. And so we're trying to focus on those same groups in our community that make it diverse and just do that in a new way through these activity kits.
Can you tell us a little bit about the projects? There's a variety out there.
Yeah, sure. So there is a project that you'll be making a Hmong necklace and learning about some of the symbols that usually are incorporated with that type of piece. And then Fox Valley Unitarian Universalist Fellowship provided us with a project where kids discover their own superpowers. So really looking at how they're unique and what makes them special and using that as their superpower. And then Appleton Public Library provided us with a project for making a tambourine. It's very representative of Hispanic culture and being able to make music in celebration. And then Wisconsin's, who focuses on families with individuals who have a disability, they provided us with a project where you make your family tree and talk about what makes your family special or unique. So a lot of different things that our kids and families will be able to enjoy in this kit.
And I understand you've been doing a lot of take-home kits like this during the pandemic. What has the response been? Has there been a hunger for projects like these?
There has, yeah. Particularly when schools were primarily virtual, we were getting a lot of feedback from families that they were concerned about the amount of screen time that their kids were experiencing. And so bringing these activity kits to families has given these kids another option to do something more hands-on. And they're really designed for an entire family to enjoy. So it's not just, you know, fit for one kid. They can really do all of this together. And we try to make them as inclusive with all the materials that you'll need for the most part, especially when we started this back last March during the actual shutdown. We wanted to make sure people didn't have to go too far from home to get the things they needed. So we try to provide them with as many materials as we can to make those projects.
And there are these take-home kits, and you also have been doing a virtual programming, I think, this month for the Diversity Month and in general. What kind of online things have you been able to do?
Yes, we have been doing a lot of amazing virtual programming. It wasn't really something that we were doing before and quickly taught ourselves how to do. So throughout this month, we have been welcoming a number of our partners to do some virtual programming. This past Friday, we welcomed the Fox Valley Symphony Orchestra and their conductor, who helped us and brought a special guest from Boston, who is a composer, and just talked about how music can be a universal language and can really break down barriers and help to really build that bridge of all diversity. And so it was a really great learning experience. And so we've been doing things with the symphony, with the library, where we'll read stories. So it's just been a lot of fun to partner with other community organizations who are trying to do the same things we are and just, you know, serve families to the best of our abilities. So really just trying to give families a lot of options.
Do you see yourself doing that kind of thing, the take-home kits and the online things, even when, and hopefully this is sooner than later, even when we're back to normal?
I think to a certain point, you know, I think that with activity kits, it's a pretty big production. You know, we're producing anywhere from 300 to 400 kits a month. And so it would just really depend on, you know, how much the museum was functioning. We obviously want to utilize some of those spaces again. So it might be on a smaller scale, but I can definitely see activity kits being a part of our programming in the future. And then for sure, looking at the virtual world, you know, as much as we talk about screen time, it is here to stay. I think using technology to connect kids to learning and education is definitely part of our future. So we want to make sure that we're continuing to offer quality programming through that new channel for us.
Beth, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Beth Vanderloop is Director of Programs and Community Engagement at the Building for Kids in Appleton. We have some links to their February Diversity Discovery Month at WPR.org/Central Time. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. This month marks the program's 10th anniversary on WPR. As part of the celebration, here's Wisconsin Life's co-founder, Ann Strain Champs, reflecting on one of her favorite stories. Features two women kneeling by a cold stream, picking something wild to eat.
From the beginning, Wisconsin Life was an experiment in rethinking what we call news. Because beyond the breaking stories and big events shaping our time, life as we actually live it unfolds on a smaller, slower, more intimate scale. What if, we wondered, alongside the headlines, we also brought you news of the everyday? What would it be like to document changing seasons, conversations with neighbors, local lore? Here's one example. An early spring day in 2012. Two young women meet to gather wild watercress in the Driftless region. The creek is swollen with snowmelt. You can hear water gurgling, songbirds overhead, the sound of scissors snipping fresh greens, a timeless ritual, and a moment in time. Meet chef and forager Danny Lind and producer Erica Janik.
There's a spring. Oh, there's a spring right there coming out of the side of the hill. See?
Yeah.
And all that watercress over there. That would be the good patch to get. There's some watercress.
Oh, yeah.
It grows all year round. It's a perennial. And in really protected spots, you can harvest it all winter if it's a spring that stays open. Summertime is generally not the best time. It doesn't like the heat. It'll get kind of yellow and it'll bolt, have little flowers on it, and it'll get super spicy and kind of bitter.
So you just snip off the tops?
Yep, snip off the tops. You never want to pull it out unless you're trying to thin out the patch a lot, but if you're someplace where you're wildcrafting it, it's definitely the considerate and responsible thing to do to leave the roots in the ground so they can just grow right back. Watercress isn't native to the U.S., but it's so naturalized that it just about might as well be. When people would come west, they would bring a little bit with them and plant it, and it pretty much just took over after that. A lot of the creeks around here are pretty darn clean. Streams that are good trout streams are good indicators of a pretty clean creek. There's a trout.
Oh, wow.
Oh, there's a whole bunch of them.
They move so fast.
They're little babies.
I've never seen a fish move so fast.
Yeah.
What's your favorite thing to do with watercress?
You know, this time of year, I really like just having a little pile of it on the side of my plate, just about no matter what I'm eating. But it's really good in salads. It's really great in sandwiches. It's really awesome. Put in an omelet, just like right when you're almost done cooking the omelet, just set in there and fold it over and it just barely wilts. That's really good. You can make watercress soup just with onions and potatoes and a little bit of milk or cream. I mean, it's one of the most concentrated sources of nutrition you can find. That's probably more watercress than we can eat today, huh?
It is quite a bit. I'm going on a strictly watercress diet.
You'd be so healthy. We could start the new trend, the new detox watercress diet. Move over grapefruit diet. Move over maple syrup lemon juice cleanse. I'd much rather eat watercress.
Watercress sandwiches for lunch.
Wisconsin Life Stories. They're evergreen. That was Erica Janik and Danny Lind on a timeless spring morning in 2012. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. You can find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Ann Strain Champs.
Hear Wisconsin Life stories all month that celebrate the program's 10-year history on Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, we look at how our lakes are about to change as spring draws closer. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, three missions to Mars have spent the last 7 months hurtling through space. Now, they're arriving at their destination. Jen White brings you all the news from ground control today at 6 on 1A+. Now, get this, spring is only a little more than a month away. You wouldn't know it if you've looked out the window or just existed in Wisconsin lately. But believe it or not, new life will slowly start to reemerge. And even our lakes will start to wake up. Soon they'll take a deep breath of air. Literally. Ted Rolsey is the editor and publisher of several books on the Great Lakes region. He writes the column, The Lake Where You Live, and is active in lake advocacy organizations. He's the author of a Lakeside Companion published by the University of Wisconsin Press. Ted, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you, Rob. Thanks for having me on.
Well, Ted, you wrote a recent piece about how lakes are starting to wake up. And it's interesting to think of, you know, a lake ecosystem hidden under the ice as kind of one organism. Could you talk about what we start to learn when we think about it that way?
Well, the lake is, in the wintertime, the lake is sort of a closed system. It's capped with ice. It might have some streams going in and out, but it's kind of a closed system, and everything is still living in there. The fish are still swimming around, the frogs, the turtles, the things that hibernate or get inactive under the ice are still breathing. And so slowly the oxygen in the water is getting depleted, and the lake is getting hungry for spring.
And I mentioned, you write that the lakes take a breath of air as the ice melts off. What happens? How does it refill with oxygen?
Well, once the ice goes off, then the water is exposed to wind and wave action, and that stirs all that oxygen in. And because the water is of a reasonably uniform temperature throughout the lake at that time of year, the oxygen is able to permeate pretty much the entire system and get everything all charged for spring and summer.
Well, I jumped ahead a step there because first that ice has to melt. And you're right, I didn't know this. I would think, oh, the sun's shining at the top of the ice, so the top is going to melt first. I am wrong. What actually happens?
Well, ice actually melts from the bottom up. The sun shining on the lake surface, the snow and the ice are very reflective. So most of the sunlight just bounces back up into the air. The warm air does do its job on the ice, but most of the melting comes from when the sunlight penetrates the ice and radiant heat heats up that bottom sediment, and especially along the shorelines where the ice is the first to go out. And then once that water is warmed up, water holds a lot more energy than air. So that melts the ice from underneath. And it actually, once it gets started, happens pretty fast.
And that ice crystalline structure is changing. What's going on?
Ice looks like a monolithic block, a solid substance, and it acts that way. But in reality, it's made up of crystals. They're kind of hexagonal crystals, a bit like the honeycomb in a beehive, and those crystals extend from the top of the ice to the bottom. And as the ice begins to thaw, the packed tight structure of those crystals begins to break down, so they start to separate. And so it's called candled ice. When the crystals are formed that start to separate, that's called candled ice, and it's very unsafe to walk on, very unstable. You can break through a foot of ice very easily with candled ice where you couldn't in summer. If you ever saw a big chunk of ice blown up onto the shore from an ice push or something and it's candled and you were to tap at that, these ice crystals would fall away and it makes kind of a musical noise like a wind chime.
That's the time of year in my hometown of Belleville, Michigan, that trucks would start to fall through Belleville Lake, I guess, when that ice starts to candle. It looked like solid ice, but it doesn't support the weight like it used to, right?
Oh, that's right. It can be very hazardous. You should, if the ice is suspect, you need to stay off.
Now, let's talk about some of the signs we really start to see. We can observe that ice melting once the melt comes to the top. I know a lot of us, I'll include myself with this, to get excited when some of those birds start returning to the open water. What's the sequence of re-arrivals there?
I don't know about I'm not a birder, so I don't know a whole lot about the sequence, but one of the first to arrive, of course, are the loons. They've been down in the Gulf of Mexico area during the summer, and in the springtime, they're making their way up. And just about as soon as the lake's clear of ice, the loons are there calling out and scoping out their nesting territories. And then later on, we'll get the various species of migrating ducks, and mergansers are pretty much the earliest arrivals, but we also get canvasbacks and grebes and lots of others coming through, some of which are going to hang around for the spring and summer and raise their broods, and some are just passing through on the way north.
We are talking to Ted Rolsey, editor and publisher of several books on the Great Lakes region, talking about the wake-up time for lakes as the ice starts to thaw and life starts to return visibly to the lakes themselves. Okay, now let's talk about the unsung heroes of the food chain here, the algae. Ted, what's the process there in the spring?
Yeah, the algae are really fundamental to the food chain. They're called the primary producers. They're the ones that take the energy of sunlight to make food that gets eaten by the little creatures, which get eaten by the bigger creatures, and so on up the food chain. And so the algae are, they die off significantly during the winter, not completely, but when the ice goes off, the water is actually pretty clear then, and it stays clear through part of the springtime. Then the first to reemerge are the diatoms, and these are algae, one-celled algae that have very symmetrical silicon little cell walls. And they actually, when they arrive, will turn the water a bit of a tinted brown. Then they will sink down to the bottom because they don't have any way to keep themselves afloat, and the green algae will then proliferate, and that's how the food chain gets started.
And further up the chain, now it's fish spawning time, sometimes even while the ice is still there. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Northern pike, for example, will sometimes spawn under the ice. They'll go back into really shallow, marshy areas. They'll be one of the first arrivals. If there's muskies in the lake, they'll be spawning a bit later and in a little bit of deeper water. And then walleyes, of course, people pretty much know as soon as the ice is out, they're going to be spawning on the rocky, gravelly bars. And later on, we get the panfish, the bluegills, crappies, large and smallmouth bass. They'll start making their nests and raising their broods.
I got to ask, Ted, a lot of people love our lakes here in Wisconsin. What led you to really zoom in so closely on lakes and what's going on below the surface?
I've enjoyed lakes ever since I was little, and especially the lakes up north. My dad took my brothers and me to a lake in the Upper Peninsula when I was about 8 years old, and I was hooked. And there's just so much to be fascinated about, just what you can observe, but being the curious sort and being kind of a science buff, I studied some limnology, which is freshwater biology, in college, and have learned about lakes pretty much as I've gone. And a few years ago, I decided to dig into it a little deeper and write a lake science column for the newspapers. And it's a way of helping people appreciate their lakes, and it's also a way for me to keep learning about lakes.
Now, there are a lot of layers, clearly, to the lakes, and you write, literally, as things warm up, our lakes will separate out into temperature layers. What's going on?
Yeah, that's right. The water on the surface warms up, and warmer water is less dense than colder water. So as the summer goes on, as the spring turns into summer, you have a layer of warm water sitting on top of a layer of cold, denser water, and the two don't actually mix very much. And the transition layer between those two zones is called the thermocline. And if you can experience the thermocline if you go fishing, the warm water on the surface, you do one of those feet-first surface dives and propel yourself down, and your feet will feel warm, 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 and then all of a sudden they'll hit cold. And that's when you know you've punched through the thermocline and your feet are in that cold, deep, cold, colder, denser layer.
Briefly, as we wrap up, Ted, are you excited to see the first thaw this year?
Oh, boy, especially after these 10 days we've just had. It's really hard to think spring about now, but I've got my pier boards piled down beside the lake, and hopefully not too long from now I'll be putting the pier in.
That sounds lovely. Ted, thanks a lot for sharing this with us today.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Ted Rolsey, editor and publisher of several books on the Great Lakes region. He writes the column The Lake Where You Live for the Lakeland Times in Minocqua and is active in lake advocacy organizations. He's the author of A Lakeside Companion. He joined us to talk about what our lakes do when the weather starts to warm up. There's a world going on under the surface. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 8, take a tour of Wisconsin Public Radio's 100-plus year history and check out some treasures from WPR archives. That's tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Coming up next is news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we take stock of the nation's roads and infrastructure. We'll find out what could be done to improve our infrastructure and help the economy in the meantime. Check out the Ideas Network Facebook page for news updates and to join conversations about what's happening on your favorite Ideas Network shows. Right now, we've got a post up about learning new stuff as a grown-up, lifelong learning, for another one of our conversations today. We would love to hear what you are learning as a grown-up, maybe in this year of pandemic. Let us know over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.